This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, welcome. TLU Vegas 22. How's it going?
So good. I'm really excited to be back in Vegas. Usually I'm happy to be here for 24 to 48 hours, and then I'm running for the airport, wishing I was back home in Maine.
But this time you're going to be teaching at TLU almost every day for 3 days. How are you going to actually stretch out your time and manage to rally every night?
I got a text when I arrived last night around 8 p.m. from someone who wanted to go out, and I was actually very good. I went to my room and went to bed early so I could be well rested for the podcast and for the lecture. So you're teaching today and every day too, right?
Today and all day tomorrow.
Tell us what you're teaching.
So Sonia Chopra and I will be talking this afternoon about voir dire and sort of our approach to it, and then we're going to have a mock jury come in and then practice on it. And I brought my iPivo, that little like Elmo thing. And Sonia always passes me notes as I'm doing voir dire. And everybody usually wants to know what's on those notes. So we're going to have it displayed up on the screen so she can show her black Sharpie complaining about how I'm asking bad questions the whole time.
Yeah, I'm interested to see that. I always assumed that she would just be making fun of you or making fun of people on the jury, but she's actually giving you real useful information.
Is actually giving me useful information.
Well, that's good.
Like, please stop. Stop doing that. You don't need to ask any more questions.
So we're thrilled to have Mark Kozaradsky here as our guest on the podcast today. Mark, you're also teaching here at the Trial College. Can you tell us what you're covering?
Well, I'm teaching kind of some funky stuff. This afternoon, I'll spend the afternoon digging deep on Rule 30B6. For those of you who work with it, it's the most powerful tool we have for catching corporations and the government lying. Now, you know, I know you find it hard to believe that that is necessary, but trust me, it happens all the time. And then tomorrow I'll be running a workshop on literally the technical steps, you know, the pick and axe work on how to do it. And then Saturday morning they've asked me to share my thoughts on how to handle a nursing home case and why it's more than a Med-Mal case and transcending it into corporate negligence and systemic neglect. So that's going to be my thing this week.
So we're going to circle back to the 30B6 stuff. I'm really interested to hear more about that. But just to go back in time, we first met each other probably about a decade ago at some nursing home litigation groups. Particularly remember one in Memphis where we were out having fried chicken. We were out listening to some great blues, a little Mustang Sally. I can
we
still
spent
see
some time on Beale Street.
We did, yeah. So it's great to see you again. And can you just tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and your practice? I know you're a trial lawyer from Minnesota, but tell them a little bit more about your background and your law practice.
Well, my background is I'm the son of Polish immigrants, and I grew up on the plains of Iowa being kind of scrappy because they had just come back from the war and being in concentration camps and gulags, and, you know, they kind of taught me you got to stand up for yourself. I went on to college and then to law school, And then I ended up in Minneapolis for the usual reason. I followed a girl. And, you know, 43 years later, I'm still there with her. So that's pretty good. I started in a big law firm, 28 partners, 150 employees, high volume practice. And I really had to earn my spurs there because the senior partner would sign up everything and then wouldn't want to try it and would throw it at me and say, Mark, go try this. After I left, I was talking to a judge and he said, I remember you. You had that case that was just a shitty case. I said, well, actually, Your Honor, my partner had a shitty case. I just had to try it. And he laughed. He goes, well played. So I went on and tried a lot of cases and hit a big civil rights case. And my first case I ever tried was one of those ones that my partner threw at me and said, you know, this is a wrongful death case, but it's terrible. So just go up and settle it for $1,000 and come back this afternoon with the money. So I said, okay, I can go and get the money. And they wouldn't give it to me. And I said, it's $1,000. I said, no. So I call them up and said, they won't pay. What do we do? And he goes, try it. Click. And hung up at the phone. I said, I didn't even know where to stand. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. You know, Raul would just cringe at the voir dire I had because when they handed me the strikes, I just did all my strikes at one time and handed them back because I didn't know I was supposed to do anything different. But, you know, the jury felt sorry for me, and I stumbled into the biggest verdict for the death of a child in Minnesota history on my first time out. So that was, that kind of got me going. And, you know, you win some cases and other cases come. And then after 17 years at that large firm, I was kind of constrained by the structure of the firm. You know, you had certain things you had to do. You had to have conversion rates, you know, you had to bill your time and stuff that kind of prevented me from exploring things I really wanted to do. So one day, without warning, I just walked in and said, I'm done. None of this midnight flight to Brazil with all the cases. I just said, I'm leaving. And I started my own law firm. You know, when you start your own law firm, you take anything. And within a couple of years, I stumbled into a nursing home case. I said, I'm not going to take this. It's, you know, a 90-year-old. What's the jury going to give for the death of a 90-year-old? And so I passed on it. And then a month or two later, another one came in. And I did the same thing. And then a third one came in and said, God, this sucks. I mean, they shouldn't be doing this to people. I don't like it. And so I took the case and started thinking about it. Yeah, what is really driving this case? You know, and what's going on, and why? What's driving my emotion? And it really wasn't so much the death, because we all die. It's how the people died. And I started thinking about, it's not just what happened, but why it happened. And as I started exploring the why it happened, I started realizing that's what motivates jurors to do the right thing. Because they don't like mama being killed for money. It pisses them off. And then they'll follow the law. So more and more nursing home cases came in. And throughout that time, I was dealing with more and more and more corporate chains that, you know, I had one nursing home with 170 subsidiaries running it. So I started unraveling the money and I started using 30B6 and, you know, it never worked. You know, they were never prepared. They never produced anything. But I started learning about it. And as I started learning more and more about it, I said, this is powerful. This thing's got some juice. So I kept working at it and it started working. Then I was asked to write the sequel to Miller and Schachter's advanced deposition book that was 30B6. I said, well, that'll be easy. 50 pages, I'll be done in a month. Well, 5 years later, 900 footnote later, 500 pages later, I ended up writing the treatise on 30B6, which most people don't even know about, and the law textbooks don't have it in there. So that's kind of how I got there.
And if our listeners aren't familiar with it, and they probably are, because you've sort of become a household name among trial lawyers on 30B6, you've written two books on 30B6, right?
I've written the original 30B6 book, and then the book was so powerful and so many people started using it that the defense industry tried to eviscerate the rule and went before the Rules Committee with 16 proposed changes. So I testified before the Rules Committee a couple times, and I mobilized a lot of people to send in comments, and the rule wasn't eviscerated. In fact, it was improved with one little step about meeting and conferring, which, although lawyers don't like it, it's really a tool that it makes it more powerful. So then I rewrote the first edition to kind of bring in things I learned when I was sitting in the Rules Committee hearings and what was affecting that panel. I tried to reconcile all the cases that seemed to be in conflict. And then I introduced proportionality from the 2015 relevance changes, as well as the 2020 changes. So the second edition reads similar to the first one, but it's on steroids.
Sorry. So when you were talking to the Rules Committee,
yeah,
how did you message to them, and what was your linchpin to convince them that 30B6 needs to stay or get improved?
Well, with the Rules Committee, it's more answering their questions. Yeah. It's kind of like being in front of the Supreme Court. You start and boom. And the big attack that was kind of the thing that the defense industry was focusing on were lawyers doing these insane notices. I mean, they brought in a 3-inch notebook, which was purported to be a notice. I mean, you couldn't read it in the time frames of the deposition. What's more, answer questions. And the Rules Committee was really upset about that. And I just stood back and said, yeah, they shouldn't be doing that. We've got a remedy for it already. It's called Rule 37. And that's where the court has the power to limit the notice. And I went on since that time to be teaching people that this isn't a cut and paste. This isn't just get everything you can find on the internet. It's all about thinking about your case and focusing on what you want. And the Rules Committee liked when I was talking about Rule 37, and then they asked me about the meet and confer, because there were some plaintiffs' lawyers who really hated it. I said, look, I'm all for it. The more we talk, the more we work together. And, of course, all the lawyers will say, well, it's just a waste of time. I says, well, it is and it isn't. Because if you meet and confer, they can't pretend to not know what you were looking for. And, you know, the Rule 30B6 isn't a sneak attack. It's, you know, it's not like coming in out of nowhere off the left flank. You just tell them what you want to know, and they got to tell you. And if you say it clearly enough, they can't run from you. They say the quality of your answers is in direct proportion to the quality of your questions.
So first of all, I'm sure everyone listening understands 30B6 is the way you can request testimony from a corporate entity where they have to put forward a human being to come and answer questions that you designate in your notice. What I've experienced, and you've alluded to it, I'm sure Rahul has had the same experience, is that you prepare that notice, you send it to the company, and then they produce somebody who doesn't really know anything about any of the topics you've identified in your notice. I've been doing some cases against auto manufacturers, and it almost seemed like they had a job description for someone they would keep on staff at maybe a senior level that they intentionally kept ignorant of all of the company.
You know, Mr. and Mrs. Know Nothing.
Right.
So, Sergeant Schultz. Know Nothing.
Exactly. They were there, you know, 30B6 witness that they would bring out for every case and just sit there for 4 hours saying, I don't know. And so how do you break through that and get real information through this process?
I've got like a whole hour on that this afternoon, but it's the long and the short of it of it is, if we understand what their duties are and lay foundations to show that they're not prepared, then if the court chooses to follow the law, and most federal courts do, and I'm finding more and more state courts are starting to. So it starts with crafting a very clear notice. If you say, tell me everything, you know, the corporation knows about the design of this vehicle, they're going to say that's not clear enough. If you say, what are the criteria that were used for selecting the alloy for the metal, now you've got something. So if you got a precise area that's relevant, then you lay the foundations by picking acts or say, are you the person who's been designated to provide all information known and reasonably available to the organization? Well, I'm here to tell you what I know. We're happy that you're going to share with us what you know, but we are here to ask what the institution knows. Are you the person who's been designated to provide all information reasonably available to the organization? And, you know, they'll dance around and just keep saying, is there going to be anybody else who's going to be sharing information? And said, I'm here to tell you what I know. He says, well, let's go over what the organization did to prepare you. Because the witness has no duty to prepare. The organization has a duty to prepare the witness. Let's go through the sources of information that are responsive to this matter of examination. Who are the people who know about this very first topic we have? Blah, 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 blah. Is there anybody else? Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Anybody else? Blah, blah, blah. Is that everybody? Yes. Did you talk to those people? Well, no, I didn't. Did anybody share with you what those people know? Well, no. How do we know that you know what they know? Well, I'm here to tell you what I know. But you've already cleared that. Are there any documents that are responsive, that would have information, that would provide the jury the information responsive to this topic? What are they? Same thing. Have you looked at the documents? Has anyone shared with you what's in those documents? And then the same thing with the electronically stored information. And then you've built this record that they're not prepared. And then I just ask them point blank, and I've got a video on it that I'll play this afternoon. Are you prepared to provide all information known to the organization about affirmative defense number 7? No. Okay. Then they said, well, I turn to the defense lawyer and says, do you have someone to substitute? And they said, well, yeah, we're here to tell you what we know. Well, I'd like someone to substitute, and why don't we meet and confer subject to everything that is in U.S. v. Taylor, and then if we can't come to an agreement, we'll let someone else decide. And I do that for everything else. Doesn't do any good to get into a fight with them. Yeah, it's just, you know, as they say on the plains of Iowa, you never win if you get into a pissing contest with a skunk. So, but you build the record. So to do that, though, you have to have a very, very clear notice, and you have to be consummately professional, and you have to just do the pick and axe work to lay the foundation. So then when you come before the federal magistrate, who will know Rule 30b-6, or if you're in a jurisdiction where you have a judge who really hasn't had experience, you give them the standard. Here's the rule. Here's the one case, the sentinel case, that says this is, they've got to be fully prepared. And then you put in this question, are you prepared to answer? No. And you just literally take the transcript and highlight it. And I find that as long as your question is relevant and not overburdensome, then you're going to win that 9 times out of 10. There's always going to be judges that just don't like what you're doing. But most do. And people talk about conservative judges and said, you know, I find that the conservative judges are the ones who like the rules. And they're, you know, they don't like us going out creating new theories, but they're all about following the rules. They're the law and order judges.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno. national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look. Steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
So what happens when you go through this process? You've got that 30B6 witness who shows up unprepared. There were probably times where you asked them for what they know.
Right.
And then you meet and confer and you go to the court and then you get the relief sought. And then the witness comes back actually prepared. What's the magic? What happens at that point?
Because 30B6 is about a lot more than getting facts. It's about the interpretation of facts and the positions of the organization. And I use the term organization because it's not just corporations. It could be any organization. Now you lock them down on the facts. Because my view of trial is the less the jury has to decide, the better. You know, if you've got a window of facts, of 50 facts that may or may not be in dispute, they start focusing on that nonsense. So you want to narrow it down. And oftentimes you find that there isn't even a fact dispute. And so once you can lock down the facts, now you have to lock down the interpretation of the facts. And U.S. v. Taylor is the case all over the country. Even California has occasionally cited to it. California has a different rule than the other states. But it says that an organization has to give its interpretation of documents. You can't have the document speaks for itself. So what does this organization claim this document says? What is the position about what happened? You lock them down to the position, and then they may be prepared on the facts, but they won't want to take a position. So then you walk them through all the foundations, say, does defendant organization have a position on X? And they usually do it. They usually take the position. I'll play a video this afternoon, a Walmart case, where I went through every affirmative defense. It was a situation where there was a garage door that came down on a delivery man's head and gave him a traumatic brain injury. And of course, the pleadings, you know, said, you know, it's his fault. It's, you know, it's a manufacturing defect, design defect, violation of rules against perpetuity and latches. And Martians did it, and this is a stupid question. I can't believe you're asking it. And you just calmly go through each one. What is the position of whether there is a design defect? Well, this is fine. And you go through all of them, and then you finally finish it, and what is the position as to what the plaintiff did wrong? And they'll object and say, what's the position on it? And they usually won't have anything. Because it's just somebody, lawyer, just making that stuff up. And U.S. v. Taylor actually says lawyers can't manufacture contentions. They can only articulate the contentions of their clients. And what they can't do is assert a position in a pleading and then produce a 30B6 witness that has no knowledge of it or no position on it. So you can lock them down on everything. And it's not just big, giant cases. You know, I mean, I've done the automotive cases. I've done the big insurance company bad faith cases. I've done it with hospital malpractice cases. But it also works on any formal organization. And so I'll do an hour this afternoon on a slip and fall in a fishing resort, which is a one-man corporation. And you know, you're from Maine. You know what those places look like. You know, northern Minnesota doesn't seem any different than Acadia, you know. And just go down and ask them all the questions, and you lock down the one-man show on everything. And I did an entire slip-and-fall premises liability case in one 47-minute deposition. Everything, including neutralizing the affirmative defenses, the open and obvious defense, everything. It was gone.
One thing I learned from reading your book a while back was that 30B6 can be a powerful way to find documents that the organization is hiding or the lawyer says they don't know about. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that, to me, that was one of the most important insights you had, and it's allowed me to find documents in many cases that I don't think I would have found otherwise.
You're spot on that. I think that's the most important tool of 30B6 there is. The first edition and the second edition have different approaches to it, primarily because the Sedona Conference took some positions on discovery and between the publication of the two books.
Discovery on discovery, you mean asking them, what did you do in order to respond to our document request, that kind of thing?
Right.
So are you still allowed to do that or not?
No. The only, that's called process-based discovery. You can do it in limited circumstances when you have laid the foundation that the document production is facially defective. Then you can do it. But that's a pretty big step you got to go through, because the courts will presume that the lawyers are telling the truth, which is often not the case, which is going to be the subject of my last book I'm writing right now on 26G. But the process we use now is you work really hard to think, what is it that you want in your case? And it's not just anything and everything and then complaining that they give you everything. Focus on what you want. And we spend a lot of time crafting our document request and put it up on the whiteboards on the mat with the magnets, and then think about every way they're going to try to weasel out of that by definitions or location. We get that whole thing done, okay? Then, once we've done that, we don't serve it. We create a 30B6 notice that has a schedule of documents in it, which is mirrors our Rule 34 request that's going to go out. But we don't serve it. We have matters of examination that follow the old federal rule and are still common, and is still Rule 26B1, and it's still talked about in the comments to the rule, saying you can ask about documents and their location and where they are. So the first question is, what documents exist in this subject matter? Number two, what is the purpose of those documents? Why are you doing them? What's the destruction policy on them? How do you disseminate these documents to intended users? Where are they located? And what would be the different ways you could search for them? So we start with the definition, because you'll say, I want a personnel file. Well, it's not just saying, you know, what's a personnel file? You say, well, what's in the personnel file? And you know what you're looking for. And you say, well, what about the job reviews or the discipline? Oh, that's not in the personnel file. Oh, really? Where would that be located? Well, that's in the discipline file. And so you've identified, and I've had that half a dozen times.
So you're saying you're putting this in a 30B6 notice and then taking that deposition early on?
Right out of the chute.
Can I ask you, how many 30B6 depositions are you allowed in a single case?
Depends on your judge. Court specific, completely. The rules, in my view, contemplate multiples, okay? And chapter 4 of my book actually gives the jurisprudence on it. Some judges say you can take as many 30B6 depositions as you're allowed to take depos. Some judges say every 30B6 notice is one deposition, even though you've got multiple notices. And other judges will say depositions are 30B6 depositions of corporations are people, and therefore you only get one without leave of court. So the interesting thing about it is in the 2020 rule change, the comments to the rule, well, the rule change says you got to meet and confer on your 30B6s. And in the comments, they talk about meeting and conferring on your 30B6 depositions, plural. There's an S at the end of that. So I think there's a good argument that the Rules Committee contemplated multiple 30B6 depositions. At the same time, when they tried to eviscerate the rule, they tried to get an amendment to the rule to limit it to 130B6, and the Rules Committee rejected that amendment. So, you know, we've got these things to show why there should be multiples. From a procedural standpoint, I think your best bet is craft all of your 30B6 notices at the same time you craft your complaint. No duplication. You have this custodial one. That's what we were talking about the document request, because you identify everything, you identify the problems, and then you ask for them. And then you'll have your substantive 30B6s. At your Rule 16 conference, say, these are the witnesses I want to take. I give them the names of all the witnesses I want, and let's get a schedule. And now if they're going to object to multiple 30B6s, now's the time that you find out about it, and you put it in front of the court and say, look, we don't want to take the same thing over and over again, but we think it's important to do this custodial one that Rule 26 contemplates, so we can find the most proportionate way to look for these documents. Because what we can do is that I don't want to be asking for documents that don't exist. I don't want to be asking for documents that are just way too expensive to find. So we're trying to consolidate that and make it easier for everyone. And courts, I've never had a court reject that. I've had courts say you only get one substantive, even though I like to take a corporate structure 30B6, so because my cases almost always have these shell games, and then a substantive one on what happened. And some judges will say, great idea, stage discovery. Other judges say, you only get two. I've never had a judge limit me to one when I showed them the reason. But going back to that custodial one, not only do you identify the documents, but then you identify where they're stored and how you can get them. Because, for example, a lot of corporations will say, we purge our emails every 30 days. You've probably heard that over and over again. And the defense lawyers will say the way to get them would be to go to the backup drives, and that's going to cost $4 million. But if you take the 30B6 and say, well, where are they purged to? They say, well, they'll go to an archive server. Oh, really? Where is that? How hard is it to search for an email there? Well, you know, we have a program to search it. Yeah. How long does it take? The machine might run for an hour, but, you know, my query is going to take 30 seconds. And so all of a sudden you've said, yeah, it's not just the backup way. There's another way to look for it. You've identified that. So it's powerful.
What happens when you get a good admission that's you've locked in on 30B6, but there's another employee or agent of the organization who has a different take or different version? Are you having success having them stopped from presenting a different version of facts once the company has adopted one? Or are they still allowed to have other witnesses come in and challenge the admission that they made in a 30B6?
All boils down to how tight you made your foundations. How much did you lock them in? The standard is, what are the sources of information? Was that information available to the organization in preparation for this deposition? Did the organization access all that information? Is there anything else that the corporation could have done to prepare this witness? And once they say, no, this is everything, then you say, what is the position of the organization on the very tight question? Now that is their position. Now when the defense lawyers want to bring in other people, they have to show that information was available or was not available at the time of the 30B6. And they're not supposed to be allowed to change it. I have a whole chapter on binding effect, because it's not as clear, as everyone says. As you know, lawyers are always certain and sometimes right. And everyone's got an opinion. Well, I locked them down on this. And said, well, you didn't. They said that, or they said they weren't prepared. And judges don't like gotcha games. They want to get to the truth. But they also don't like games of trying to weasel out of the truth. So if you've laid it down solid, and then they come up with a new witness, there's a case called Rainey that says, well, if you can show that this information was unavailable at the time, then we can allow you to reopen this. But if that information was potentially available, then it was their responsibility to get that information to the designee, and then the organization could determine what position they were going to take on that information. But again, it goes to the judge. But if you always start with the premise, the judge is trying to get to the truth, but they don't like people trying to weasel out of their responsibilities, and your record is clear, you can have success most of the time.
No, Rahul has a couple 30B6s coming up.
One of this facility here, not the Mandalay Bay, but the MGM. So I've got that coming up pretty soon, and then a school district abuse case. But everything you're talking about is so helpful, and I am in the minority. I haven't read your books yet, but I'm going to now, and I'm super excited about that. So thank you for sharing everything you've got. It's fantastic.
My privilege.
Yeah.
One last question for you, Mark. Are you still doing a lot of the nursing home cases, and are you seeing trends in that industry? Because what I, for a number of years, did a bunch of them, but at least where we were, we saw some of the bigger chains were exiting the industry, and it just didn't seem to be as, we weren't seeing as many cases. And I just transitioned to doing more of the pure medical cases and out of doing so many nursing home cases. But are you still doing those, and what do you see in there?
We've tried 4 since January 1.
Wow.
Of this year?
Yeah.
Wow. So is this the prime focus of your practice still, is doing the nursing home cases?
I mean, I help people with 30B6 on all kinds of cases. I join trial teams, kind of a consulting, helping them craft the notice, strategizing what you need to get, figuring out how the courts will deal with it. But the vast majority of our cases, I'd say 80%, are elder abuse cases of some kind. California, which you have the best elder abuse statute in the country, it's a great line of business. And there's so much business, you can't even get your head around it. I turn down between 6 and 8 cases a day. Yeah, that's how many people call. And it's not because they're not meritorious cases. I just don't want to build a law firm of 28 lawyers again. We have a firm it's a boutique. I mean, it's my partner and I, and we've become pretty skilled on discovery and the use of the rules and trying cases. But then we have a lawyer who's a second career, who's an MD. We have another lawyer who's a second career that was an ombudsman in the nursing home industry. And then we had a third lawyer who was an investigator for a medical examiner before going to law school. So, we've got the team, but we dig deep. But the work you do, you can't, it takes, nursing home cases take a lot of time. They're like hard med mal cases, but they also have biases that go to your benefit, because people are just horrified of what's going to happen in a nursing home. Those biases are slowly changing over in the med mal world, but not to the level they are in the nursing home level.
Yeah, I agree. Well, so if our folks need help on 30B6, or they want to talk to you about a nursing home case, how do they find you, Mark?
They can contact our firm. It's KozLawFirm.com, KozLawFirm. Then all the phone numbers and bios and all the stuff are on the page. If you go to Minnesota nursing home cases, we're at the top of the organic searches all the time. So it's easy to find us.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with all of your teaching here at TLU.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.